The following program is brought to you by Podcast One Sportsnet. Don't forget to download our new Podcast One app.
He is currently the head football coach of the University of Michigan Wolverines and a former player. His dad and brother are also former players and coaches, but there is more to them than just football. It's time to talk about attacking life each day with an enthusiasm unknown to mankind. This is Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's Podcast with Jim Harbaugh.
Welcome to Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's Podcast, episode number 37. Ira Weintraub here. I've got Jim Harbaugh, Jack Harbaugh, Matt Dudek here as well. And you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. You can listen via the Podcast One app or on PodcastOne.com. I highly recommend downloading the Podcast One app and then clicking the heart when you go to the Attack Each Day Harbaugh's Podcast. That way it's in your favorites. It's always easy to get to, and you can listen to us each and every week.
You know anything
when
about
this podcast
that,
shows
Jack?
Up.
I'm completely in the dark. This heart stuff, and what are we?
Hearts liking, you, favoriting.
Like, so I have liking. No idea. We're going to, after the show is over, you got to take me through that.
Okay, I'll be happy to do that. It's like,
it's like what they, it's like what they say on Judge Judy. Like us on.
You're right. Like us on Twitter or like us on Facebook.
And follow us on Facebook.
There you go. That's it.
You know, when they make that announcement on it.
I think I'm fast forwarding through that part of it. I don't recall that at all.
But you're on a DVR, so you have some technology.
I do.
Experience, so you're good.
I do
all
have
right.
that.
We got a tweet last week from @kdime15 tweeted in, met the star of AED podcast today. Had such a great time hearing stories and learning life lessons. It was like a personal hashtag Jack talk. Who's got it better than me?
Nobody.
So he had a chance to meet you last week. So I wanted to thank you for your time, Jack. So welcome to the podcast and really fun to be back here this week. And I know last week, Coach, you were down in Peru. And it's a trip you've taken before. I was curious how your daughter enjoyed the trip to Peru.
Oh, thanks for asking. She was a tremendous young missionary. She built houses. She visited a girls' orphanage. They gave her a uniform and welcomed her as a sister. And they didn't want her to leave. She didn't want to leave. And we were there on two different days and bought food at the market. She delivered food as part of the program at Santissimo Sacramento. She was amazing. She was great. Spiritual. She was at Mass every night, and she really cares a lot about the dogs. Mm-hmm. She endangered species of all kind, animals of all kind, and really befriended probably 12 different dogs that we encountered throughout our trip there.
It's like we're just random wild dogs kind of roaming around? Or
there's two dogs, Benicio, and there's another bee named dog that lives at the church.
Okay, gotcha.
That she saw every day, multiple times a day. And then, other dogs that we were out either building houses or that we came across. She loves animals, doesn't she, Dad?
She always has. I mean, ever since she started to walk and could talk and started to draw those little pictures like kids do, it was always about animals and endangered animals. I remember here in the office walls, you'd come in here on the outer wall, and in your office there would be these pictures scotch taped up to the wall.
She says she wants to be an animal control officer or a veterinarian when she grows up. But you always, and we have a dog. We have a dog now, Annie. Your fear as a parent is, okay, we get this dog. We're not getting a dog because as soon as we get the dog, you're not going to walk it. You're not going to feed it. You're not going to take care of it. You're not going to pick up after it. That has not been the case with Addie Harbaugh. That dog is
I will say that we have encountered dogs in raising our children. You might remember, and you bring me a dog, I'll get up every morning
right.
with it and walk it and feed it. And that lasted about
I promise.
2 weeks, and the dog lasted with us for 4 weeks. We took it back to where we got it because this wasn't going to work. Remember
we
that?
We had one dog. We had one dog.
That was the dog.
It was a big dog, too.
It was a big dog.
A great thing. I was maybe five or six. John was
There was a family here in Bowling Green that
seven.
Was moving.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to take the dog, so talked Jackie into taking it. came over to our house for about 2 weeks, and there was a, 1 week of enthusiasm to doing the things that you had promised to do. Second week, you went dark on us. Family went dark on us. Third week, the house, the dog was somewhere else. It wasn't in our house.
Coach, you say it was a Great Dane?
It wasn't that big. Okay, it seemed like a big dog. We were little, though, at the time. So it did something with the flowers. I know it did something. I have a stark memory of it doing something with Mom's flower bed, and the dog was gone shortly after that. So I don't know if all the fingerprints were on the kids.
How about this, Jim? Annie came first. We've been in our house now there for 2 years, and Annie came about a year ago.
Yeah.
And so Annie just thought that she had the run of houses. You know, she felt she had the run of your house, and she came.
She didn't get
to
go into Mom's.
No,
Mom's house.
The kids tried
to come inside the house.
Kids tried to bring it in, and Annie doesn't come in here.
They have been well trained to know that Annie doesn't get to go in there.
Annie doesn't have free run. They kind of leash her outside. So
they were a little upset at Grandma. It still kind of sticks in their craw that Jay Harbaugh. And Brittany Harbaugh's dog, Storm, got to come in Grandma's house, but Annie's not allowed into it. So
it was almost a boycott. If Storm's going to come in here.
Huh? Was Storm older, or was Storm also
no,
a puppy at the time?
It was just a real puppy. I mean, it was only like a couple weeks old when it came over. Oh, so Jackie kind of loosened up some
point.
Of the rules with dogs on Storm, and our grandkids next door couldn't understand how Storm was getting any extra privileges.
And growing up, we never had any pets. There was the dog for 3 weeks in Bowling Green, and we had a rabbit at some point. Maybe in Iowa we had a rabbit. Or was it Bowling Green?
Bowling Green. Rabbit got out.
We got a rabbit. The story was that the rabbit got out and was never seen from again. Can you shed any light on that?
And then, well, the next day,
there was a rip in the screen. How this rabbit was able to
claw his way out
or chew his way out of a wire mesh screen?
I must go on record and say, the fact we had rabbit the next day had absolutely nothing to do with the rabbit getting out.
I always thought it was the pet farm. The pets go off to the pet farm when whatever the reasons are that the pet is no longer with you.
How did that cage get built? That was a
Joseph Petey.
I think it was a Joseph Petey built.
A well built cage with some very nice wire meshing.
You know, it's
somehow
funny.
Smart rabbit.
Things that go into your mind. I can recall you. I don't think it took months for you guys to forgive us for something that we had nothing to do with.
I kind of went with it, but now, I mean, as I think back, I mean, I was only five at the time. There seemed to be like an L shape.
You think some neighbors?
I think somebody. Anything you want to tell us?
Did we not look for the dog for hours? I mean, not the dog, but the rabbit. We looked for that rabbit for hours trying to find it. So you got to think we had nothing whatsoever to do with it.
I don't remember that.
Or it's a good cover
story. I remember. He'll probably come back. He'll probably come back. When he gets hungry, he'll come back. Dad, he's out there. We're going to find him. He'll come back.
And he never came back.
Never came back.
I'm sure that rabbit had a great life somewhere else.
I hope. I can only hope.
Or you have a guilty conscience?
Not at all.
I do like hearing, though, that Addie, as early as you can have kids learning about pets and learning about community service and learning all those kind of things, the earlier the better. I'm trying to figure out that age on the community service side with my daughter who just turned five, but she either torments or loves our dog. It depends on the moment of the day, but she definitely knows how to take care of and that kind of stuff at five. But as she gets older, well, the community service stuff, I might even bring her over to the Humane Society here in town. They do a great job of
They do.
The
Addie does it. Addie goes once a week to the Humane Society.
It's a great place.
Yeah. She pets dogs for like an hour and a half, 2 hours once a week. She loves it.
Yeah, it's a great place.
Yeah.
And it's a no-kill shelter for those that ask questions, because if they hear Humane Society, it's a no-kill shelter. So every dog, cat, everything gets adopted out. And so great place. They do great work here in Ann Arbor. We're talking a little family time. How about a shout-out for Devin Bush Sr. and Jr.? They're daughter/sister, Deja, mm-hmm. is in the championship series of the College World Series in softball at Florida State.
It's fantastic. I know Coach had a chance to go to the ball game over the weekend, and he was the proud father. Mm-hmm. The buttons on his shirt were popping. There's no question about it, and it's great family that's accomplished so much And we're pulling for part of the family.
Jack, for you, I mean, you've had a chance, obviously, being the dad watching your kids. So you probably understand what Devin Sr. is going through as he's watching his daughter play at this level. Or for that matter, when Devin's out there playing for you guys. But here's his daughter. So he has no relation to the game other than being a fan that he can cheer on his kid. And you've been in that position countless times with your kids.
Well, the interesting thing is when you watch your kids, you actually live every pitch. You live every play with them, and you're so caught up in wanting them to have success and wanting them to, you know, to be a part of that team. So it's an amazing experience. And whether you're a Pop Warner, whether you're in a tennis program with your children or junior high school or college or professional, it really doesn't matter. It's the same experience every time you have a chance to see one of your youngsters compete and play and be a part of a team.
And that brings us something that I think is one of the coolest things that you guys are doing. And you can get more information at this at MichiganFootballCamp.com. But on Father's Day, you guys are doing a father-son camp. So ages 5 to 12.
And daughter.
And daughters.
Oh, and daughters. Okay, that's good to know. Starting at age 5.
Matt Dudek's twins will be there.
And Abby, the 9-year-old, she'll be there too.
Okay.
It'll be great. And it's not just specifically for fathers. You know, it's uncles or mothers or whatever the case may be.
But a two-generation thing.
Yeah, two-generation thing.
And, but how cool. Where did that idea come from?
Really, I think Sean McGee came up with it, sitting with Coach and going through and talking. And it's going to be a wonderful – it's going to be more than just a camp running over bags. It's going to be a wonderful experience. You know, it's the other things of Michigan football. If you have a tie to the program, if you're a fan of the program, if you're a fan of Coach, you're a fan of Jack's, coming down and just experiencing that family, that Michigan football family, and being a part of it for the day, that's really what we're trying to offer.
I had a chance about 3 or 4 years ago. Tom Crean had a father-son camp at Indiana, and Tom ran the camp, so he couldn't do it. So he asked me to do it, and I was probably 72 at the time, and these other fathers were in their 30s and 40s, and I was really the oldest guy out there, and they were very, very competitive, and it was one of the more humbling experiences of my life. We got into these pickup basketball games, and I was trying to jump, and I would jump, and my body felt that I was soaring into the air, but my feet weren't getting off the ground. I was still in contact with the ground, and the ball would roll away, and I would go to get it. And about the time I would go to pick it up, it rolled a little more. Then I had to go a couple more steps and a couple more steps. And the guy that was getting the biggest kick out of it was Riley.
It seems like he likes to have fun with his grandfather, and probably in both directions, in the fun and the but he's.
And I'll say this:
experiences with Riley.
It's a fantastic, fantastic experience, and I would recommend for any father or uncle or anyone that would like to be involved to be a part of it. It'll be something that we'll remember forever and a long, long time.
Great.
We just had a youth camp this past weekend in the big house, and got to maybe close to 200 youngsters
200
were there and their families. And you could see the parents were so so happy and so into it to watch their kids out there running around. And had a chance to meet each one individually and take a picture with them. And I probably had about 7 youngsters that came up to me and said, you know, I'm going to be playing for you someday, Coach. Or, you know, look at me in 7 years. I'm going to be
Don't forget me.
Don't forget me. And, I've had maybe a half dozen players through the years where you did the youth camp and they ended up actually playing for you.
That's awesome.
You know, at some point. And I was one myself. I told Bo Schembechler that at a youth camp and when I was 9 that I was gonna play for him someday. And
we started the Michigan camp system here back in 1976.
73.
Gary Moeller and I think it was Bill McCartney started it. They had no idea how many they would get. And when it got to 75, the two of them were gonna handle it, and then they got to 75 and then they brought Denny Brown and myself aboard with the first camp and brought Jim over, if I remember. And I was working with the defensive back, so he was my scout team quarterback type guy. He was running the option and he was coming down the line of scrimmage, and I enjoyed the week with Jim, and John was involved in it as well. I enjoyed that as much as I did the campers. So that
the first year, the very first year you had the camp, we were able to participate. I was 9, John was was 11 or 10, and we got to be in the camp. Then the next year, you made it. There were so many kids that were in the camp that you made an age limit on it. And then I had to. Then I think we were ball boys for a couple years. Yeah. But you know, this is good. We've as Matt said, Sean came up with the Father's Day idea, and we've always done the youth camp. Mm-hmm. But it's great to have the youth campers out there, and you know, getting them to maybe that's their first experience in football. Maybe they're going to sign up for Little League football this year, you know, part because of that. But it's the enthusiasm that they'd have, you love, and you had a chance also. Who are our guys you brought over? They got the Blue Noses.
The Blue Noses came from Adrian. The group that we saw the other day came from Kalamazoo. A great group. Jim Hess brought them over, former women's basketball coach at Western Michigan when I was there, brought a group of about 12 youngsters over and came over. They were in their ties and shirts and had a chance to see the building, took them over to the big house, and they dressed down here into their T-shirts and game day attire. And one of the great things we did, we brought them on the field, we put them in the tunnel, and we've created this picture for them. Now, when I stand here and say, go, I want you to we're going to sprint out onto the field. We're going to run to the 50-yard line. You got to imagine there's a banner, a blue banner up there. I want you to jump as high as you can to hit that banner, then run to the other sideline. And when you get there, just stay in a little circle, and I'll come join you, and we'll break the huddle, right? So we gave just like, you know, you would just go, go. And these 12 kids are running out across the field. They got to the 50-yard line and gave it a leap up as if they were touching the banner. To the other side of the field, go. We ran over. Okay, on three, go Blue. One, two, three, go Blue. And then just kind of look around. 110,000 people welcome you onto the stadium. I mean, you could just see there.
It was great. I had a great experience yesterday. Was over at the Sound Mind, Sound Body camp in Grand Rapids.
900 kids?
Yeah, there was a lot of them. And our youth impact program that we do here every single summer, two youngsters from our very first youth impact camp, they were sixth graders at the time, and they came up to me. So they're juniors now.
Golly.
And they came up, and two friends, I remember them because we rode the bus together from the yellow school bus from Detroit to Ann Arbor on the first day. And these two youngsters, two friends, they were probably in the sixth grade or so, and we were talking. They were real outgoing kids, and they came up to me yesterday at the camp, said, remember us, remember the bus? I said, yeah, absolutely, remember it. And both of them are still playing football and doing well in school. So that's a neat thing. I mean, you know, they don't forget, and we don't forget, and that's you know, some of the great things that come out of the youth camps. I just love them.
Last thing before we get to our guest for this episode, which he is
Nate Forbes, Nate Forbes in the building,
vice chairman of the Cleveland Cavaliers, amongst many things. But last Thursday, your dad did a terrific job, like he always does, giving a speech, giving a talk at the Concordia Hall of Fame Gala. And it was the first time I've had a chance to watch him tell the story of meeting your mom while your mom is in the room. That's part of it, which is fun to watch her reaction while he tells the story. But after the event was over, guy comes up to Jack, and he says,
"Amazing!
So you met your wife in Professor Hamilton's biology class at Bowling Green.
Wow.
So did I. This guy, many years later after, was same professor, same biology class, same school. He met his wife as a freshman at Bowling Green the same way that your parents met.
The difference was that at the end of the class, he claims that he got an A. I think I pulled a C- in that biology class because I was so enamored with that Sapiti in that first row that I claim to this day, and I'm sticking with the story, I would have done much better in that class had it not been for her, the distraction that she had caused me. And you know who that was, Jim?
No, who was it?
Dan Boyster's son. You know, Dan was a coach over at Eastern Michigan. First coach of the Detroit Wheels.
How about that?
It was his son. And then we closed out the program with a high Zicky Zumba.
Doesn't get any better than that.
Doesn't get any better than that.
Coming up on the other side, Nate Forbes, Vice Chairman of the Cleveland Cavaliers, joining us here on Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast.
Want to take this opportunity to thank our sponsor, TrueCar. Here are some useful tips you might not be aware of. A coffee filter and a little bit of olive oil can clean your interior. Removing excess weight from your car will improve gas mileage. And you can place your key fob to your chin to increase its range. Weird, right? But I've tried it, and it actually works. Well, here's another tip you might also not know about. TrueCar also helps people get used cars. That's right. TrueCar isn't just for buying new cars. With their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you'll enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience, whether you buy new or used. And with TrueCar, you just can see what others paid so they know if they're getting a good deal before buying. They're also more likely to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with TrueCar certified dealers. Whether you're ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident buying experience. Some features not available in all states. We hope you enjoy the Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast, and you can help us make your listening experience as enjoyable as possible by participating in a Podcast One survey. Help our podcast stay free to download with minimal ads. Responses will help align the appropriate advertisers to our audience. It's a short survey and it's completely anonymous, and it really helps us out. It takes no more than 5 minutes. There are two easy ways to take the survey. You can go to podcastone.com/mysurvey or go to podcastone.com and click on the survey banner. If you filled out a survey in the past, we thank you, but we still need you to do it again. You will do us at Attack Each Day, a Harbaugh's podcast, and at Podcast One a huge favor by filling it out. Thank you for supporting our program and for taking the time to complete the survey. So once again, you can go to podcastone.com/mysurvey or go to podcastone.com and click on the survey banner.
Now back to Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast.
We're now joined by Nate Forbes here on Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast. He is the vice chairman of the Cleveland Cavaliers. He's the president and managing partner of the Forbes Company. He's on the board of directors of Jack Entertainment and Rock Gaming and so much more. I could probably go on a long time with your titles and all the things that you do. Welcome to the podcast.
Boy, I sound pretty important, but I got to tell you, every night when I walk in my own house at home, I'm not very important.
No, I don't think you'll sell yourself a little bit short there. So people hear Cavaliers, so we'll start on the NBA side of things.
Honorary captain of the Michigan football team.
That's very important. Honorary captain, big-time donor here for the university. Giving back, I think, is a really important part of what you do for Michigan, for the community, medical. We were talking a little bit before we started. I always love hearing about guys when they give back, and I want to get into that too. But we'll start with the Cavaliers because, obviously, NBA Finals is a hot topic right now. I think what a lot of people want to know, something that I was thinking about, because you see things, because I get asked questions about people that I know, and people say, what do you think about this guy, or think about that guy? What is LeBron really like?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you something. He is a basketball savant. His basketball IQ is as high as any person's IQ in any sport I've ever seen. He sees things on the court before they happen, and he's actually two or three steps ahead of everybody else on that basketball court. He is one-of-a-kind athlete. He keeps his body in such pristine shape. He invests in his body. He invests in his teammates. He invests in the community. He is a great, great human being and a great proponent of what it is to be about team and what it is for internal growth, and he's one of a kind.
One thing that really jumps out to me, take all the basketball stuff aside, he's never gotten in trouble. You never hear about other women or anything like that. He gives back. He's sending, I don't even know how many kids now from the state of Ohio to college. And most of the time you hear about athletes that, even the superstars, that there's something else going on or you hear a little story. And he is, from 18 years old, he's been a pro. And for that matter, he probably was a pro before then. But since 18 years old, he has been a pro. And he has never gotten in trouble. And he is an upstanding citizen.
First 7 years of his career, he played in Cleveland. And obviously the last four. Mm-hmm. And he is everything that you say he is and more. And he's been through a lot of teammates, a lot of coaches, a lot of front office personnel. But above it all, he maintains such a sensibility about him that it's easy to follow him. Whether you're a teammate, whether you're a community-involved person, or whether you're just part of the organization, he's an easy guy to follow for those reasons.
Tremendous organization. Fourth year in the finals.
Fourth year in the finals, Jim. Down 2-0. Mm-hmm. We were down 2-0 against Boston. Mm-hmm. This is a little different. We're against a much tougher opponent than we were against Boston, much deeper team with a lot of weapons that has been there 4 years in a row against the Cavaliers. So it puts it at a little bit of a higher level, and it's much harder to come back because the energy that it takes in an NBA Finals game mm-hmm. is different than every game preceding. It takes so much and expends so much energy to keep up with the pace. There's a mental grind and a physical grind. And when you're in the NBA Finals, the mental grind and the preparation for each game and the demands on you and your time are so great that when that ball goes up in the air and you start that opening tip, you have some level of exhaustion that you take into the game. Mm-hmm. And then to keep it at such a high level, and LeBron's been playing, as you guys have been watching, he's on the court almost every minute mm-hmm. of the game. And it's really unprecedented in the NBA to see a guy have to log so many minutes. He's played in over his 100th game this year. Mm-hmm. First time in his career he's never missed a regular season game or a playoff game. So it takes its toll, for sure.
And on the entire team, you see, it's into June now, and your team's done this for the last four straight years. I can tell you're tracking it. I mean, you have to. You sound like somebody who knows the GPS and knows the statistics, the minutes. And,
yeah. So LeBron's in his 15th year, and if you add all of his playoff minutes on top of it, he's equivalent to over a 17-year career at this point. So his playoff minutes and games have added over 2 years to his career time span. And a guy of his size going to the basket as much as he does takes a physical beating that is, you know, it's really hard to believe that he has not had sustained a major injury. He has never been in trouble, whether in basketball or outside of basketball, and he's kept himself at a level that we haven't seen in a long time.
We can also throw in that he missed a couple of off seasons because he was playing in the Olympics and giving back to his country representing Team USA.
And still dropping 40.
Yeah. Getting battered, beaten, hit in the eye, all kinds of stuff. And
there are all these good things, but is there any way we could turn him maybe from Ohio State to Michigan in his loyalty to a university in the Big Ten Conference?
I'll tell you, Jack, over the years I've had one conversation with him about that. It didn't go too well.
So I take that's a no?
That's probably a strong no.
Well, we'll still be rooting for him. In fact, we're going to be in Cleveland. On Wednesday night.
There's a game on Wednesday night.
There is a
in
game.
Cleveland.
I thought about it.
I want to bring that up.
I thought so many times I ought to take you to a game, but I don't think they'd let me in the front door, let alone the back door.
It's all right. We got relatives in Cleveland. We'll slip somewhere and watch the game.
Yeah, one of the great Indian fans in America sitting right here. So got the Ohio representation.
Jack, what was your favorite Indian baseball team of all time?
1948.
Give them the whole roster.
Kenny Keltner at third base. Lou Boudreau, the shortstop. Joe Gordon at second base. Eddie Robinson was our first baseman. Dale Mitchell, number three, number 34 in 48, but he changed his number to three in left field. Larry Doby, number 14 in center field. And Bob Kennedy in right field. Pitching staff, Bob Feller. We had a guy named Gene Bearden, was the hero for 1 year, and then he kind of dropped out of sight. Bob Lemon, the curveballing pitcher that was the manager yeah. for two or three times with the Cleveland yeah, Indians, sure. was also there. And one of my all-time favorites, catcher, number four, Jim Hegan. I don't know if you remember that or not. He had a son that played as well. There were a couple of relievers that I think I'll just skip over for time's purpose.
You got it. I think you know it.
Got it cold.
Did they win the World Series?
We did.
Did.
In fact, that's the last time that the Cleveland Indians has won a World Series, but there's always hope.
They came real close 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, ooh. So close.
That was unbelievable.
That rain got us.
Yep, that rain delay. It's funny how that works.
We've always followed the Cleveland sports, thanks to Dad, my mom, Jackie, who grew up in Cleveland. And we had a run there. There was a run in the 70s where the 90s. Cavs were really good. We used to listen on the radio. Nate Thurman.
Pete Franklin
was...
Do you remember Pete Franklin?
Yeah, sure.
Still around?
Oh,
my goodness. No, he's passed
no,
away.
No,
he passed
no, he's
away?
Gone. Yeah, yeah.
He used to hang up on people. I remember that.
Kid, you're 12 years old. It's 7 o'clock. Go to bed.
7 o'clock, go to bed? I wish I could impose that on my kids
but
in my house.
He didn't want to deal with kids on the phone. When they call, that's how he got rid of them. Go to bed. It's time to go to bed. You got school tomorrow.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That's an incredible recall. I'm hoping that down the road my 83 Orioles team that I remember will still be in my head.
83 Orioles? 83 was that Orioles. Mike Cuellar?
No, that was 79.
Oh, 79.
That was 79.
Yeah.
No, 83 was a few years later because I could do the same thing, righty lineup, lefty lineup, pitchers, I could do the whole
One
thing.
One of the great left. I think he was a left-hander. Dave McNally.
Yeah, he was in the 79 team.
Dave McNally. Remember Bo McNally?
Yeah, Bo McNally. That was his Bo's grandfather was Dave, the pitcher.
I think he saw the last pitcher to hit a home run in the World Series in 1979 against the Pirates.
Wait a minute. They also had 4 20-game winners on that team. When's the last
McNally,
time?
Palmer and Dobson.
Did Palmer.
Yeah.
Andy, Dobson's the one they always forget.
Andy Etchebarren was
one of the catchers. Elrod Hendricks was the other.
Hendricks.
And this is actually before my time, but you could tell my dad raised me right. My dad used to tell me, he'd ask me all these sports trivia questions, and he would say, it's on the SATs. So when I got home from my first SATs, I cussed him out and said it was not on the SATs. I failed. But it suits me well now, I guess. So it works.
Dudek,
well.
You got any you're a Pittsburgh Pirate? Don't say Steelers. We're not allowed
to. No, Steelers. Not a Steeler fan. Dolphin fan growing up. But Pirates, the 91-92 Pirates. That's like my heyday. I had all the baseball cards. Jay Bell, Doug Drabeck, Mike LaValliere, Jay Bell, Jose Lien on second base. Ken Griffey. Andy Van Slyke, Bobby Bonilla, Barry Bonds in the outfield. That was my heyday.
Well, you and I talk about maybe the greatest baseball player of all time, Willie Mays, right?
Willie Mays. Mm.
There might have been one with the Pittsburgh Pirates that would challenge Roberto Clemente.
Great arm.
Oh, who said arm? Oh my goodness, he could throw it. He could throw it literally from the wall to home on a line drive, direct shot. I mean, he had a tremendous arm.
We got to be careful talking too much Pittsburgh with a Cleveland guy here Michigan guys here. Yeah. So is it interesting to have a Michigan guy and a Michigan State guy with a team in Ohio? Is that interesting?
You know, it used to be early on. It's kind of worn off, and it's just kind of become part of the landscape there. And, you know, every time they put up the university, when the opposing team shooting free throws in the Michigan Block M goes up on the scoreboard and the whole stadium boos, you kind of revel in that a little bit, Jack. You know what I mean?
I can imagine.
Yeah, but it's kind of worn off a little bit.
You and Dan do any smack talk back and forth, Michigan State stuff?
A little bit. I always tell Dan, he and I got one thing in common. We both applied to Michigan.
Absolutely right.
We have, Pennsylvania's good to us, so here in Michigan.
Absolutely.
Michigan football.
Best players from Pennsylvania and Ohio will come up here for
Chase
sure.
Winovich, Kalik Hudson.
Jim, how does that break down? Like, how many recruits come from the state of Michigan, like on the roster today, on the team today? How many people from Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, or other parts? What's the biggest regions of the country?
We have the most players on our team from the state of Michigan. We have the most scholarship players on our team from the state of Michigan. Our next is the state of Florida. Next is Ohio. And that's... That's the breakdown, and there's 16 scholarships. Oh, there's over half of that number from Michigan that are starting. Same with Florida. There's over half, good percentage of our starters from the state of Ohio actually start.
Is that changed?
And 3 out of 4 starters from the state of Pennsylvania. So we do look at that percentage and know that we have to recruit heavier in Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Has that changed since you've been here?
Dad, I mean, that was Michigan, Ohio, and Florida, Anthony Carter.
Anthony was the first player that we really actively recruited and got. Bill McCartney did a fantastic job, Riviera Beach down in Florida, and got him to come visit, took him away from Florida State. And that kind of was like we talk about the olive jar and prying. Once we got him out of the olive jar, they started to flow out of Florida a little bit more. But our teams back in the 70s were probably more Ohio players on the team than there were Michigan players. Bo had that connection at Miami of Ohio with Ohio recruiting and brought a lot of those youngsters to Michigan.
Yeah, it's a conscious effort that Coach and I have talked about of getting back into Ohio and Pennsylvania. We have 3 or 4 coaches recruiting Ohio now. We're going into Pittsburgh. We're going into camps in Cleveland and Pittsburgh. And we're also covering the Philadelphia area. So that's really big and kind of grabbing those guys, get them to come to Michigan, get that pipeline going again. And Al Washington, Mike Zordich, Ed Warner, those guys have been doing a fantastic job of bringing names back. They just all got off the road spring recruiting. And we probably spent of their 16 days each, they probably spent at least 5 or 6 days seeing players in Ohio, Pennsylvania, each one of them. So,
you know, I was early on, before I gave our family donation to athletics here, we spent a lot of time understanding. Dave Brandon was the AD at the time, and talking about the whole facilities rebuild at the University of Michigan. And one of the things Dave understood, and I was a big supporter of, is in the recruiting effort, football and basketball, all the way down the line of sports, how important it is in recruiting today to have the most contemporary, modern facilities. It's a real draw for these kids today to be able to come into a facility. If you look at what's gone on around here with the football and the player development centers and the practice fields and the basketball redo of the arena and the player development center and all the fields now on South Campus that are being redone, how important is that in recruiting of today's athlete to have facilities at that level?
Well, I mean, the biggest safe, you know, biggest net that you can have of support, you know, the biggest amount of support, you know, each year I do this, it becomes more and more clear, you know, the more is more. And in terms of coaching, in terms of health and welfare, terms of your strength and conditioning, your development, the academic support, the professors do an incredible job here. The University of Michigan is the top school in the world, in my opinion, and the job that they do. It really, you know, so it you need that support because of the type of player that you really need to recruit at Michigan. And there's three major factors to me. Number one is they've got to be a good student. They've got to be able to compete up on campus on in a world-class university where there are no jock degrees on campus. Also, they got to be a good person because nothing gets swept under the carpet here at the University of Michigan. You know, a youngster gets a parking ticket, they got to pay for it. You can't come in and say, hey, coach, can you pay for this parking ticket? No, that's not going to happen. You know, there's good consequences for good behavior. There's bad consequences for poor behavior. That's the way it is at our university. And the third thing is they got to wake up wanting to smash somebody.
It's the most important part, right, Jack?
I said we could start from three and go to one, one to go to three.
it takes all three of those at the University of Michigan. And and want to smash somebody for Michigan because we're playing against all the best teams in the country. So,
but back in the day, you talk about Anthony Carter, Jack, and even when Jim played. I mean, you played on a piece of carpet that just sat on a level set concrete that wasn't more than a quarter to a half inch thick.
Yeah,
right.
I can't tell you the number of injuries in the 7 years I saw here where a player was never hit on that turf. I mean, they would just plant their feet in there and they'd get locked. And then they would pivot and bang, something would tear. I mean, it was actually playing on an asphalt parking lot with a thin layer of carpeting and a small layer of padding under that. Facilities have just
changed.
From the 70s now has totally yeah. changed. And all the Power Five programs are all fighting and scratching to take it one notch higher, and that's what creates a great demand for continuing to stay on board and stay ahead of the game.
Yeah, we're under construction right now. Phase one just finished. We have the biggest, largest weight room in the country, and our guys are using it literally as we speak right now. And from a recruiting standpoint, when a guy walks in there, it's
in
your
wow,
face.
Right?
It's a wow factor, and it's more than just the wow factor. You can have you can have waterfalls and slides and all that stuff, but like Coach said, it's about what makes the guys better. How can we support them better overall, academically, athletically, personally, so that we can get the most out of them and we can win championships here?
It's the form of recruiting free agents. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what you're doing mm-hmm. with high school mm-hmm. athletes is trying
Absolutely.
To recruit free agents because in theory they're all free agents and they have the choice of anyone to number one of the Division Great. One schools, and the top athletes can go where they want.
And it's the same with the university. You can see this with universities across the country. You know, they're trying to attract students, and you know, are better. You know, the dorms get increased, the facilities on campus, the support for the students, you know, their safety, their welfare, and letting them compete in the, you know, out in the world. And Michigan is second to none. I mean, what is the applications just for the entire university for students? I mean, it's
close to
60,000. I was going to say 60. Yeah. You know, that's incredible. So, I mean, that shows you where Michigan competes with the rest of the universities in the country.
I mean, Jim, we just finished a $4 billion Victors for Michigan campaign, which I ran the state of Michigan, and we blew through it. And it took us about 16 months less than the projected timeline. And today we're at about $4.6 billion for that campaign. And that's the third campaign in the last 15, 20 years. Wow. But as you talk about the breadth of the alumni base in the University of Michigan, wherever you go in the world, mm-hmm. you travel the world, it is unbelievable where you've come in contact with. And at the high level of business and enterprise that Michigan graduates are involved with around this globe is amazing.
A couple questions. One, where do you get all the time to do what you do? and secondly, when you're raising that kind of money, where does it go throughout the university?
Well, the university sets the priorities. So they have a development department that runs all of the fundraising. And obviously with all the different deans of the different schools, they set the priorities. It goes to the Board of Regents. They approve a budget. So you take a $4 billion campaign and you put it into buckets. And then medical in a broad scope got $1 billion. Scholarship and endowment got $1 billion. So they develop these buckets. And within those buckets, you have allotments. And then you get your volunteer base organized. And once that volunteer base is organized, the University of Michigan Development Department, led by Jerry May, runs that whole development team mm-hmm. of people, his in-house people and his volunteers. And it takes a huge effort to mobilize that many people. Mm-hmm. And the tentacles of the University of Michigan are so deep and so broad, and the number of large donors that they get and the way they go about disseminating the information and garnering, it's a lot like you on a preparing for a football Saturday. I mean, you're developing a team of people and getting a swell of ground level of support to go into that campaign to sell your programs. And everybody has great experiences here from the University of Michigan. So sometimes it's an easy sell. In hard times and when the economic times are down, it's a little bit more of a difficult sell.
Well, which leads me to my next question. I don't know, and again, I don't know if you're going to have time for this, but I can't think of anybody better. Just had the idea of trying to educate our players on how to budget their money, how to invest it. And as you look up, we're not talking millions of dollars like the professional athletes do. And I know you have player development programs and in place for them. But do you think we could do that on a educational scale here at the University of Michigan with our athletes, with our female and male athletes, to where, you know, many get a Pell Grant, which is thousands of dollars.
It's about $5,000 over the year.
And they also have a cost of attendance, which is above their scholarship, and they have off campus housing and they have a rent check, meal check, et cetera, that they get. So they should have hundreds of dollars, $300-$400 maybe,
yeah,
at the end of the month, that if they were in budgeting right and investing right, that somebody with your experience, could you teach us that? Could you teach us
so
how to do that?
The NCAA has no program by which they force you to educate collegiate athletes as to how to budget and save money. It's interesting.
No, that's something that is a gap right now, and we could start right here. Somebody of your experience.
Yeah, professional sports, it's a requirement for all the teams to do the business of basketball or the business of football or the business of baseball. And part of that education process is to talk to players about how to save money. Your earnings, your savings, surrounding yourself with people you can inherently trust is a very big thing. Because inherently, a lot of athletes get a lot of people gravitated to them for a variety of reasons. And next thing you know, they're investing in this thing, the other thing, and the next great idea. And invariably, a lot of that stuff will fail. And then they're left, by the time they pay their agent and pay their taxes, they figure out there's not a lot left. And they need to understand the basic program of what they make, take out money to pay agents on the professional level, mm-hmm. and then pay your taxes. And then if you want to take care of family or certain family members, and what's truly left at the end of the day, and how you have to save and conserve, and what that can turn into if you do it the right way. And there's several examples of what that can turn into if you do it the wrong way. But I'm surprised the NC2A doesn't have a mandatory education program to start at the collegiate level to teach college athletes how to save and conserve their dollars during their time at the university.
Something we can do here.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And there's a template that can be we could develop, and obviously it's an easy one for the coaches to talk to about to their players, whatever sport it might be, because it's important that they start getting that in their head today, whether they end up playing professional sports or in business.
Well, Nate, what percentage of professional athletes over a period of time don't spend their money wisely or don't invest wisely and then end up maybe back to square one? Is there a number? Are there numbers on that in the NBA?
There is, and it's higher than you would think. But it's a very high percentage of professional athletes that file personal bankruptcy at some point during their life to get out under from all the incurrent debt that they've incurred mostly during their playing days. And what a lot of athletes don't realize is you got to look at the scope and the span of your career. Because when you look at a professional football player, what is it, Jim? Less than 4 years, 4.2 years?
Yeah, the average is three and a half or three and three quarters.
So when you come in and you're a high-level athlete, you think it's going to go on forever. And it just doesn't. And you got a lot of demands and a lot of people wanting this, that, and the other thing. And it's very high, Jack. I want to say it's north of 40% of professional athletes file personal bankruptcy during their careers at some point. And I think it all starts with education. It really does.
And I think it's a process, too. It isn't a one-day seminar at the end, at the beginning of a school year, or one-day seminar beginning of a professional athlete's career that's going to do it. I mean, it's got to be constant reminder and opportunities for them to learn.
And having good influences in your life that surround you, you know, and it starts with family and starts with that type of support system. And obviously the university and everything you guys do here is part of that support system.
Is there a percentage that somebody that, you know, is just starting out? So if we could train them, you know, while they're in college, to then when they get to the pro level or they get to the level where they're having a job, that they can have some habits, some spending habits, some saving habits, some investments habits, some, you know, I guess money for the bare essentials, and then
I would tell you that if you take a look at your earnings minus your taxes, less all your obligations, not credit card obligations because that's voluntary, but any other obligations. Do you have student loans you got to pay off? Do you have debt of mortgages that you have? So when you back out all of your obligations, debt obligations, then I would say anywhere between the low end of 30%, but more closer to 50%, of all of your take-home pay should be stashed away in some form of retirement or savings account and not be touched. And then if you want to take that other 50% of whatever's left to live on and buy clothes and take vacations and other things, that would be a nice range for people to at least have in their minds as a template. So what else is going on, guys? How was the weekend?
It was great.
Good.
Yeah, Coach was on the road hitting the satellite camps, as he talked about earlier. And
yeah, myself and our coaches have started camps. We had a youth camp on Saturday. We also did three other off-campus camps. Myself and the other coaches have spread out. We're gonna be doing that. As I said, we'll be in your neck of the woods in the next couple of days, and then headed to the East Coast as well. So getting a chance to look at football and coach football at the high school level here for the next 2-3 weeks.
And we open up on – we got three tough road games this year.
Ooh, right out of the box.
Right out of the box at Notre Dame.
At Notre Dame.
At night.
That's our next one. That's our next game. Be a great opener. Great game. It's a historic game in college football to me, to us. And but it also motivates your team, I think. When you look at the opener and it's going to be against a great football team, that that game is staring you right there in the face, and you know it's coming, and you got to get prepared for it.
We had the same circumstance last year with Florida. Remember opening up in Texas? I mean, our team was focused and prepared, and
boy, they played a hell of a game. That
played
day.
A fantastic game on that day. So good things.
And then there's Jack Talk.
This is Jack Talk.
I want to listen. I want to be better. I want to be the best I can be.
Welcome to our team. The team.
Jack Talk.
As you get older, you get to be 78 years old. Here's what I find. Hair grows in places that it hadn't been before.
Welcome to hashtag Jack Talk.
Time for everyone's favorite segment of the Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast. Hashtag Jack Talk. And this week, Jack, we pay respects to one of the – it's kind of like the Harbaugh family's got that name. There's the Mallory family where the dad, the boys, everyone got into the family business. Of course, here we know the boys because played here. Kurt actually coached here not that many years ago. But Bill, the dad, the patriarch of the family, obviously started that football legacy and unfortunately recently passed away. But you had a chance to go to his celebration of life down in Bloomington, Indiana.
Oh, we did. What an outstanding experience. Bill Mallory, we go back to 1959 to 1958 when I was a student at Bowling Green State University. Bill was only 4 years older than I was, and I was a junior defensive back, and Bill had graduated from Miami where he was a captain along with his two brothers, the family. All three brothers were captains at Miami of Ohio. He went out and coached at East Palestine High School. Had a great record. Came to Bowling Green. Dwight hired him as a graduate assistant. And when you talk about an enthusiasm unknown to mankind, and you talk about a passion and love for the game of football, Bill Mallory was unmatched. And in that, so he was promoted to defensive coordinator in 1959, and he was anxious to make a mark. And some of the stories, Ira, can only remember with great fondness. The one was, we were in a huddle one time and things weren't going well and Bill didn't like it. So he came up and grabbed a player by his shoulders and headbutted him. He had no helmet. All he had was his bare head. He headbutted a guy with a plastic helmet. Boom! And a little bump came up on his head and the blood started to seep out a little bit. And then he went to the next guy. Boom! And you, boom! 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 He went right down the line, and I'm in the back row. I was a defensive back, and I said, my God, he's not going to go through this entire team. Sure enough, boom! He had, I'm looking at his head, and there's 11 bumps on his head, and the blood coming out, and you're just thinking, oh, my God. And just played it at a different level. Tell the Bill story with Dwight. No one could give a pep talk like Bill Mallory. I mean, the snot balls would come out his nose and the spit would come out. You've been in a situation where a spit ball comes out. Mm-hmm. And when you in a meeting with him, no one sat in the first two rows because the spit balls would actually one row, two rows. And when they're coming out, you don't want to dodge them because you don't want to embarrass them, but you don't want to take a hit either. And it can be very disconcerting and disturbing to trying to stay with the conversation, but passed out giving a pep talk in one of our games right before the ball game, and just a tremendous passion. And no one told a story like him. You would be after later he would tell a story, and when he started to tell a story, he lost his breath because he was laughing so hard at his own story. You know, tears would be coming out of eyes. And he had this habit of his knee. His knee was just knee jerk. It was just pounding up and down. And it was with such force, it would actually, if he were behind a table, move the table. And so he'd be telling the story, couldn't catch his breath, tears coming down, couldn't get to the punchline, knee gone. And you enjoyed watching him tell the story as much as you did to be able to see. But wife Ellie, he was married at the time, and I told each one of the four children, the three sons and Barbara the daughter, that in 1959 Ellie and Bill Mallory gave Jackie and myself a roadmap on what it was to be a football coach, to be parents, and to be fathers, and Jackie to be mothers. And that was 59 years ago, and we're still on that roadmap, that design they gave us for doing it the right way. And then on from Bowling Green, he went to Yale, where he coached with John Pond and Carm Cozy. Did that.
That was one of the things that jumped out to me when I was reading about him when he passed. He is on amazing coaching trees. You talked about Doit, Ara Parseghian, of course, who he played for, and later when he went back to Miami, he became a part of the cradle of coaches.
Exactly. That's the key word, cradle of coaches. All those guys back in the 50s, I mean, that truly was the cradle of coaches. Ara Parseghian, Bo Schembechler, John Pont.
Right, and he was the guy who actually replaced Bo when Bo came here.
And exactly, and I think Bo might have replaced John Pont, if I'm not mistaken. But John Pont's wife was at the celebration over the weekend, and she has to be into her 80s and early 90s, sharp as a tack. And I was recruited at Miami at that time. Paul Dietzel came out of that cradle. Paul Brown came out of that cradle. Earl Blake came out of that cradle of coaches. So those guys had this giant fraternity, and they all kind of supported one another and looked after one another, and it became such a model for coaching and for the university.
What was it like for you? It was within the last couple of years, I guess, when they honored John, to be a part of that, to go down and see him with all those guys that were your coaches, your peers, your contemporaries, et cetera. And here's now your son, who's included as a Super Bowl champion, included in this group of coaches.
It was one of those magic times. You know, you'd say those one or two or three things that you look back on. Because in growing up, these were the guys that I wanted to be like. They were my heroes. They were my mentors. And then to see him being recognized with them, and a statue of him right across from Bo Schembechler, I mean, golly, it was humbling and is humbling. And Ira, over 1,000 people were at that celebration over the weekend. Coaches, former players, friends, fans, people that just wanted to come and celebrate a life. We got there at 3:00. On Friday at the funeral home for being able to meet with the family. And we got there at 3:30, started at 3:00. We got there at 3:30. At 6:00, we had a chance to work our way through the line and get to where we could offer our condolences to Ellie and the family. And then Ellie was there until 9:30. Before the line stopped. I mean, the line was continuous from 3:00 in the afternoon till 9:30. And I say 1,000 people had to come through there. And every place you turn, there was Elliot Uzlak. There was Jerry Hamlin. And there was someone else that you coached with or you coached against. Former players that I played against and played with at Bowling Green. It was just a tremendous, tremendous tribute to a man that's given so much to our game. I just want to tell this one quick story. As I say, he was a great storyteller, and he talked about when he was a coach at Ohio State, and he was coaching for Woody Hayes. And Woody had these what he called the collateral duties. You know, you might be a defensive line coach, you might recruit Central Ohio, but you had a collateral duty, and Bill's was the weather. He had to be able every day at the meeting at 7:30, Woody, it's going to be sunny and clear today. The temperature, the high will be 52, and the low will be 48. No precipitation today. And that would be his job, to know the weather. But on this one occasion, it was during fall camp, and gave it the weather, no precipitation on that particular day. And they had the meeting at 10:00 at night. He's driving home. He had a little Volkswagen popping down the highway in the little Volkswagen, and raindrops were beginning to hit his windshield. And he realized that he had mentioned in the morning meeting that there would be no precipitation, which meant that the practice field for the next day would not be covered. So now he realizes that, and he thinks, I'll just drive home and go to bed and pretend as if it isn't raining. And the old man may not be very happy about that, or I can go back to the building, the facility, where Woody would still be working, looking at film, and tell him that It's raining. Now it's not just dropping now. Now it's a downpour of rain. So he decides to wheel his car around, and he goes back. And sure enough, Woody's in there all by himself looking at film. He says, Woody, we got a problem. It is pouring rain, and the field is not covered. Field is not covered. Oh, people have all gone home. The maintenance people have gone home. We can't get the tarp on the field. Give the coaches a call. Tell them to come back. We need to get the tarp back on the field. So he calls one guy, and the guy's in his pajamas. He got home, he's in his pajamas. You got to come back. So he comes back. He's got another guy came back in a cardigan. Remember those cardigan sweaters? Mm-hmm. He had a cardigan sweater. He's a neatly, nattily attired guy, and he came back. So the whole staff's there, and now Woody's going to be the general. Grab the tarp! And they're grabbing the tarp, and they unroll it, you know, and they spread it out, and grab that end. And they all got the ends, and the guy in the cardigan sweater now, the sweater's down over his hands, you know, and it all stretched out, and the guy in his pajamas. But you can just see, this is Big Ten football under Woody Hayes. We're putting the tarp on. Now, a huge wind comes up, and the wind blows, and the tarp goes up in the air. And they're trying to hold on to it, the coaching staff, and Woody's a general, and the tarp comes over him and kind of buries him under the tarp. And they can hear this guy, help, help, it's Woody. And so all they got the tarp on, he says, I swear to God, we looked around and there were about 11, 12 of us there holding the tarp. And we thought to ourselves, should we let him go? Maybe it would be good for all of us if we just kind of let him go and pretended that if we didn't hear it, so they kind of got it up to where he could crawl out from underneath the tarp. And you could just imagine now, by the time he's telling the story, he's crying. He can't catch his breath. His knee is bouncing. And I heard that story 50 times, but no one ever could tell the story quite like he could tell the story.
At Indiana, took Indiana to 6 bowl games, was a highly successful at Indiana. While his boys came to Ann Arbor to play football for Bo, he was highly successful at Indiana, which we know how difficult it can be to win at Indiana. Shows what a kind of a coach that Bill Mallory is, 2-time Big Ten Coach of the Year. He previous to that, 2-time MAC Coach of the Year, and a guy that, you know, when you talk about, and I think you'd probably talk about your former coach, Dwight Perry, as a guy on this list as well, where there's a generation, you know, maybe mine or and then beyond, where names that kind of get lost in the shuffle. Like, we'll hear about Eric because he coached at Notre Dame. Not because he was at Miami, but because he was at Notre Dame. We know Bo, we know Woody. But there are certain coaches from the 60s, 70s, and 80s that may get kind of lost in the shuffle of how good of coaches they were and where they were because they weren't at the biggest programs. But if you hear 6 bowl games in Indiana, Michigan fans will go, well, he must have been a pretty good coach. If they didn't know who he was already, what kind of coach he was.
To me, one of the great tragedies for Bill is that he's a Hall of Fame coach. He's a college football Hall of Fame coach, and he's not in the Hall of Fame. And the chances aren't good that he will ever be in it for this reason. To be in the college football Hall of Fame, you have to be really considered, you have to have won 60% of your games. If you have, it's kind of the cutoff line, and they've been very, very. There's only 2 coaches that I know of that have not won 60% of the games that's in the Hall of Fame.
He's Bill, close, but he's not close. There.
I think he's 58% or 59, like somewhere close like that. But anyway, when he went to Miami, he followed Bo at Miami and had an outstanding record there. They went undefeated 1 year, beat Florida in a bowl game, if I'm not mistaken. Then he took a job at Colorado that was okay but not great, built that into – now, you got to remember in those days now, Ira, in the Big 8, it was Switzer at Oklahoma. It was Osborne at Nebraska. Those guys were battling it out, and he was kind of an outlier. He was kind of a guy – but he beat those teams at Colorado, and he went to bowl games. Very, very successful. Got crossways with one of the boosters out there, one of the big boosters that wanted to tell him how to run the team. And he very politely told him that he would run the team and lost his job. They lost his job. So he was out of work, came to Northern Illinois. That program was in the dark ages at that time, as I remember. He built that into what it has become, Northern Illinois. I say Northern Iowa.
Yeah, Northern Illinois.
Yep. Northern Illinois built that program into a class program, then went to the University of Indiana. Indiana University, it was nowhere. First year at Indiana, he went 0-11. Next year, he went like 4-7, something like that. So he, if you're going to be 60%, when you build a program like that, it's very, very difficult. You're not going to a winning program. You're not along. Then he built that into a program where they went to 6 bowl games. Wasn't good enough for a guy named Brand Miles or Miles
Brand. Yep.
Miles Brand.
Yep.
It wasn't quite good enough. They wanted to take a step up. You know, they wanted to take a so they let Bill go.
And we see what happened. Has happened in Indiana since.
And we see what it is, still is trying to find a way to get to where Bill Mallory had that program, in my judgment. So it's going to be, you know, he didn't get to the 60, but there ought to be every year, if you're looking at a Hall of Fame, is there a coach out there like that, that because very, very successful, but because he built programs that weren't good into successful programs, they should be recognized or at least given some consideration for that honor.
Absolutely. Great stories. Always Jack Talk's always terrific, but great stories about your friend and one of your colleagues, Bill Mallory, passed away recently. And I know you guys had a chance to have that celebration of life. I like that phrase that we've had a few over the many years, but celebration of life, because he obviously had a terrific life and left behind a terrific family.
And just one parting moment is he had 11 grandchildren. All 11 grandchildren took the stage at the church. And one of the granddaughters got up and made a very, very tearful tribute to her grandfather, her papa, and it was so moving. And then each one, Mike, the oldest captain here at the University of Michigan, got up and spoke and did a fantastic job. Doug, who's now with the Atlanta Falcons, Mike is with the Jacksonville Jaguars, got up and talked about his dad. And then Kurt, who's the head coach at Indiana State, talked about his father. And seeing the three sons up there, they all look like him. But more so than just looking like him, they enunciate. They hold the podium the way he used to hold the front of the podium. And he used to call it, he would lock his jaw and bow his neck. And that they would lock their jaws were locked and their necks were bowed as they made their presentation and did just an outstanding job. And then daughter Barbara, she out in Colorado, and she gave one of the great talks about the passion that Bill had. He loved horses, so he bought her a horse, and the horse wasn't quite behaving the way he wanted. So she, I don't know if she said he hit the horse, punched the horse in the nose, or threatened to punch the horse in the nose. Can't remember, and I don't want to get into any trouble, but I thought to myself, that is Bill. If that horse isn't going to do it his way, he's going to feel the wrath of Coach Bill Mallory. So I greatly enjoyed the weekend and have such love and tribute for Ellie and Bill Mallory.
Another great hashtag Jack Talk here on Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast. You can contact us on Twitter using the hashtag Jack Talk. You can also reach us on Twitter at AED Podcast, or you can reach me at Ira in Ann Arbor. You can follow us and favorite us on podcast1.com and the Podcast One app. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes. And thanks to Podcast One. Thanks to sponsor TrueCar. Have a great week and keep Attack Each Day with enthusiasm unknown to mankind.
Thank you for listening to Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast, here on Podcast One. Don't forget to subscribe at podcastone.com, the Podcast One app, or Apple Podcasts.